Welcome to The Deep Dive, the show where we cut through the noise and get straight to the most important insights from a mountain of information. Today, we're plunging into the federal news update for Wednesday, August 20th, 2025. I'm Alex Johnson, your guide for this deep dive, and joining me today to help us unpack everything is Sam Kennedy, our expert.
It's great to be here, and I'm really looking forward to diving into this. I'm Sam Kennedy.
Okay, so we've basically gathered a whole stack of sources, articles, research, our own notes, and they detail some pretty extensive actions by the U.S. federal government just since the beginning of August 19, 2025. Our mission, like always, is to pull out the most important nuggets of knowledge, the key insights, really give you a shortcut to being properly informed about these rapid shifts happening across all branches of government. We're not just looking at what happened, but really digging into the immediate impact, and maybe even more crucially, the sort of longer-term implications. And honestly, what's unfolded in just this short window? Well, it reveals some genuinely significant strategic shifts going on in Washington. Okay, let's unpack this and get right into the executive branch, which has been remarkably busy.
Yeah, remarkably busy is probably an understatement. What we've seen from the executive branch, particularly hitting hard on August 19th, it really can be described as a high-tempo, multi-front effort. You get this strong sense of a singular, top-down, strategic direction driving things. And it's fundamentally reshaping the U.S. government's posture, both, you know, at home and on the world stage.
And that strategic push really seemed to kick off with some major moves from the White House itself. Especially on the diplomatic front, didn't it?
That's absolutely right. The White House was definitely the epicenter of a lot of this activity. On August 19th, we saw President Trump hosting what the administration was really heavily promoting as a historic summit with European leaders. Now, this wasn't just, you know, a routine meeting. It was specifically framed as an event meant to reshape U.S. foreign policy, and the method was key. Direct, high-level, leader-to-leader channels.
Interesting. So prioritizing those direct talks over, say, the State Department's usual processes.
Exactly. What's really fascinating here is that deliberate prioritization of direct negotiations. It seems designed to often bypass the more traditional, sometimes slower, diplomatic routes that involve career diplomats, established institutions, that sort of thing. It suggests an administration that wants to cut straight to the chase, deal directly with heads of state, and use U.S. power to get specific, tangible results rather than maybe relying on broader multilateral frameworks.
Okay, I see. So faster, maybe more direct outcomes potentially. But what are the downsides to that kind of approach?
Well, that's the other side of the coin, isn't it? While it can potentially lead to rapid agreements, it also carries this inherent risk of, well, alienating allies, particularly longstanding partners who are more used to a predictable rules-based international system. They might feel sidelined or pressured, and that could definitely strain alliances over the long haul.
So direct leader talks seem to be the preferred mode. But then almost immediately after that summit, there was also this very, very pointed effort to manage the narrative around some really sensitive peace talks. What was going on there?
Precisely. That's another key piece. While that summit was happening, the press secretary, Caroline Leavitt, spent a significant chunk of her press briefing aggressively pushing back against media reports, specifically reports suggesting breakthroughs in the ongoing Russia-Ukraine peace negotiations. And she didn't just, you know, deny them. She went further, explicitly accusing certain news outlets of putting out lies and fake news.
Wow, that's strong language. More than just spinning the story.
I think so. This doesn't feel like just typical political rhetoric. It looks like a highly proactive, even aggressive strategy to manage public perception. And what it strongly suggests is that these talks are at a truly critical, maybe fragile stage. The administration clearly sees any unauthorized leaks or disclosures as a major threat to whatever their objectives are in those talks.
So the intense focus on controlling the story implies what? What might they be trying to achieve or prevent?
It implies the negotiations likely involve really sensitive concessions or perhaps details the administration wants to frame very carefully, you know, on its own terms, to maximize how it looks politically when or if a deal is announced. They want to be the only source for any official word on the outcome. But this approach, it creates this environment of increased uncertainty for international partners, for observers, anyone trying to figure out what's really happening.
Yeah, you're stuck trying to figure out what's real, the official denial or the leaked report.
Exactly. It leaves people trying to decipher the truth between the official line and what might seem like credible, though denied, media coverage. It feels like a calculated effort to build a specific narrative, one that preemptively tries to delegitimize any information that doesn't come straight from the White House.
It almost sounds like, as you said, a multi-front effort, diplomatic on one side, informational control on the other. Now, beyond these really high-profile White House moves, what else was happening on the foreign policy stage that day, August 19th?
Well, alongside those very visible White House activities, you had the Department of State under Secretary Marco Rubio pursuing its own sort of parallel diplomatic tracks. Also on the 19th, Secretary Rubio had separate phone calls, one with Kenyan President William Ruto and another with the Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan.
Okay, so not just focused on Europe and Ukraine then?
Not at all. And these aren't just minor courtesy calls. They're dealing with distinct regional issues, bilateral relationships. It really underscores that the administration has a broad global reach, extending well beyond that immediate focus on Europe and Ukraine. It paints a picture of comprehensive, even if not always traditionally multilateral, engagement across the globe.
And then we have the U.S.-Thailand trade agreement. You flagged that earlier as a kind of textbook example of this transactional diplomacy approach. Can you break that down a bit more?
Yeah, it really does exemplify it perfectly. This newly finalized U.S.-Thailand trade deal, it represents a truly significant shift in their bilateral economic ties. So the U.S. agreed to reduce its tariff rate on Thai goods. It had been threatened at 36%. It came down to 19%, which is still pretty substantial, mind you.
Right. And what did Thailand give in return?
In exchange, Thailand granted zero tariff access to its market for most U.S. goods. Now, on the surface, this gives some immediate relief to Thai exporters, and it opens up the Thai market for American products. But what's particularly interesting and potentially tricky for Thailand is what some analysts are calling a potential twin influx.
A twin influx? What does that mean?
It means the potential for both U.S. and Chinese goods flooding into the Thai market simultaneously under different agreements or dynamics. This could present really complex long-term economic challenges for Thailand as it tries to navigate heightened competition from two global economic giants at the same time.
And how does this specific deal showcase that transactional diplomacy?
It showcases it because it's a very clear example of leveraging U.S. economic power in this case, the threat of very high tariffs to achieve very specific tangible outcomes. Namely, getting greater market access for American goods, it's a very direct quid pro quo, and it notably sidesteps those broader, often more complex and slower multilateral trade frameworks. It's deal-making, pure and simple.
So when you piece all of this together, the direct leader talks, the aggressive narrative management, these specific bilateral deals, what's the overall foreign policy doctrine that seems to be emerging? What's the thread connecting all these actions?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And when you do synthesize these actions, you see a pretty coherent, pretty consistent foreign policy doctrine emerging. And that is, as we said, transactional diplomacy. It fundamentally prioritizes direct, often bilateral, leader-to-leader negotiations. It frequently seems to bypass or sideline the traditional diplomatic professionals and the established multilateral institutions. And a key feature is how U.S. economic power is explicitly used as leverage to get specific, tangible results, usually on that bilateral basis.
And the potential downside remains the risk to alliances.
Yes, that's a major implication. While it offers the potential for, you know, quick deals, it carries that significant risk of alienating allies who are used to, and frankly often prefer, a more predictable, rules-based international order. They might see this approach as less about shared values or long-term strategy and more about raw power plays.
And the information control aspect adds another layer of difficulty for them.
Definitely. That information control piece, like with the Ukraine talks, just adds to the uncertainty for international partners. It makes it harder for them to really understand U.S. intentions, U.S. positions, when official statements and media reports are constantly clashing. It complicates planning and coordination.
Okay, so while foreign policy is being dramatically reshaped through this transactional lens, the domestic front saw an equally, maybe even more, aggressive assertion of executive power. And here's where it gets really interesting, especially concerning this major domestic security operation that seemed to really escalate on August 19th.
You're absolutely right. The domestic sphere saw an equally, if not more, aggressive assertion of executive power. The administration launched what really can only be described as an unprecedented federal law enforcement operation right here in Washington, D.C. And this wasn't a slow buildup. It seemed to surge into full force specifically on August 19th. The White House framed it, of course, as a necessary response to a declared crime emergency. But it immediately sparked widespread concern and, frankly, debate.
And what was the legal justification they used for this? How did they actually take control?
The legal foundation they cited was an executive order signed back on August 11th. That order placed the District of Columbia's own Metropolitan Police Department, the MPD, under direct federal control for an initial period of 30 days.
30 days initially. What happens after that?
Any extension beyond that initial 30-day period would need explicit approval from Congress. So that's a key check, down the line at least.
And this wasn't just, you know, a handful of FBI agents showing up, was it? It sounds like a pretty massive deployment involving multiple federal agencies.
Oh, far from it. This is a substantial multi-agency task force. We're talking personnel pulled from the FBI, from IC Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the Department of Homeland Security, the U.S. Park Police, and the U.S. Marshal Service, all working together under this federal umbrella.
And were local or National Guard forces involved too?
Yes. Significantly, this core federal group was substantially augmented, first by about 800 D.C. National Guard members who were already on duty, but then an additional 1,100 National Guard troops were requested from Republican-led states, and they were deployed pretty rapidly into the Capitol.
Wow. So a very large force. And what was their stated mission?
Their stated mission, as articulated by the administration, was clear. Restore law and order and make the nation's capital safe again. That was the public justification.
Okay, so that's the setup. What were the reported results of this operation in those initial days around August 19th? And what kind of tactics were residents actually seeing on the streets?
Well, as of August 19th, the administration was reporting 465 arrests and the seizure of 68 firearms. But what really stands out and has drawn a lot of attention and criticism is the very strong integration of immigration enforcement into what was presented as a crime-fighting operation.
How so? What were the numbers there?
Of those 465 arrests, a really significant number, 206 people were identified by the task force as being undocumented or illegally present in the country.
And the tactics used.
On the ground, residents reported seeing things like stops of individuals by agents, often in unmarked cars, sometimes wearing tactical vests. These agents would then question people about their employment status, about their legal residency status. And to encourage tips from the public, the U.S. Marshals even put out an announcement offering a $500 reward for crime tips that lead to an arrest.
With an operation this visible, this impactful, using these kinds of tactics, how did it affect the city's residents, especially, say, in immigrant communities?
Yeah.
And what about the local economy?
The impact was described as profound and immediate, particularly in neighborhoods with large immigrant populations, like Columbia Heights. Reports described a palpable climate of fear taking hold very quickly. Local vendors, small business owners, reported that their business just plummeted worse, some said, than even during the peak of the COVID-19 pandemic lockdowns.
Worse than the pandemic. Why?
Because people were actively avoiding public areas, commercial streets. Both customers and even fellow merchants, especially Spanish speakers, according to these reports, were staying away because of this pervasive fear of encountering federal agents, of being questioned, potentially detained. This economic disruption was apparently so severe that some business owners described a complete halt to commercial activity in certain zones. It was crippling these local economies, going far beyond just targeting specific criminal activity.
Given that impact and the tactics you mentioned, there must have been significant pushback or skepticism from local DC officials or residents themselves.
Absolutely. A lot of skepticism and criticism surfaced very quickly. While President Trump was asserting that the operation was making the city safer every single hour, local officials and many residents openly questioned both its necessity and its actual focus. They pointed out, for instance, that these federal troops were often seen deployed quite conspicuously in low-crime tourist areas, not necessarily concentrated solely in the neighborhoods experiencing the higher rates of violent crime that were the supposed justification for the whole thing.
And wasn't there also something about the Department of Justice investigating DC's crime statistic?
Yes. Adding another layer of complexity and contention, the Department of Justice launched an investigation into whether DC officials had been reporting fake crime numbers, essentially, allegedly downplaying the extent of the crime problem.
Which could be seen how? As a genuine effort to get accurate data, or...
Or, as critics suggest, it could certainly be seen as a strategic move. A way to retroactively justify the federal intervention by suggesting the local government couldn't be trusted, while simultaneously undermining the legitimacy of local authority and their data, which might contradict the administration's narrative.
This really takes us beyond just a standard crime crackdown. when you analyze it deeper, what does this operation really signify? What are the broader implications we should be thinking about here?
You're right. It's unequivocally more than just a simple crime-fighting initiative. It really appears to be a kind of blueprint, maybe a test case, for a significant expansion of federal power over local governance. It functions almost like a live fire exercise in how to federalize a city's police force, how to explicitly bypass elected local officials, and how to overtly merge routine criminal law enforcement with federal immigration enforcement authority.
And the executive order was the key mechanism.
Yeah, that executive order declaring a crime emergency provided the necessary legal, or at least pseudo-legal, mechanism for this assertion of authority. And the multi-agency nature of the task force is crucial, too. It effectively blurs the lines between local policing, federal criminal investigation, and determining immigration status. It creates a new, much more expansive model of domestic security enforcement.
And the DOJ investigation plays a role in this blueprint, too.
A crucial political role, yes. That simultaneous DOJ investigation into the city's crime data works to undermine the legitimacy of the local authorities who might challenge the takeover, while also validating the premise for the federal takeover. It's a pincer move, almost.
So the implication is that this could be repeated elsewhere.
That's the big concern. This combination of actions, declaring an emergency, seizing control of local police, investigating local data, establishes a repeatable precedent. If it stands here, it creates a powerful tool that could theoretically be deployed against other cities or municipalities, particularly those with differing political leadership or policies the administration opposes, like so-called sanctuary cities.
And the potential third-order effect of that.
A potential chilling effect on dissent among mayors and governors nationwide. They might become hesitant to criticize federal policy or implement divergent local policies if they fear similar federal intervention in their own jurisdictions.
You also mentioned the severe economic disruption in these D.C. neighborhoods. You hinted it might be more than just an unfortunate side effect. Could it be a deliberate part of the strategy?
That's a critical and frankly disturbing point to consider. The evidence suggests the severe economic disruption wasn't just collateral damage. It appears to be, quite possibly, a deliberate consequence of the operation's chosen tactics. Think about it. The highly visible presence of heavily armed federal agents, the explicit focus on questioning people about immigration status in commercial districts. This predictably created that climate of fear that crippled local economies.
So economic pressure as an enforcement tool itself?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It functions as a strategic tool of enforcement. By making daily life and commerce untenable, particularly in communities with large immigrant populations, the administration can potentially advance its policy goals through attrition and intimidation, even without needing to conduct mass arrests or deportations. This tactic severely weakens community cohesion, punishes jurisdictions for policies the administration disagrees with, and the long-term third-order consequences are really profound. Potential for significant social displacement as people leave those areas, and a deepening of mistrust between these communities and all forms of law enforcement, not just federal. That complicates effective governance and genuine public safety efforts for years, maybe decades to come.
So while domestic security is being reshaped in this really profound and concerning way, you mentioned there was also a significant coordinated shift happening in how the federal government approaches regulation across various agencies. It sounds like a broader philosophical push was underway simultaneously.
Yes, that's another critical front in this multifaceted push we saw unfolding around August 19th. We observed a series of announcements from multiple federal agencies that, you know, if you looked at them in isolation, might seem disconnected. But when you put them together, they revealed a deeply synchronized and ideologically coherent effort to reshape the nation's regulatory landscape. These weren't just isolated agency actions. They really looked like a centrally directed push to implement the administration's overarching deregulatory agenda.
Okay. Can you walk us through some of the specific agency actions from that day that illustrate this coordinated effort? Let's start with the Department of Transportation.
Certainly. First up, the Department of Transportation, DOT, formally announced it was terminating its rulemaking process for something called Notifying Air Travelers of DOT's Aviation Consumer Hotline. This rule would have required airlines to prominently display a toll-free number for consumer complaints. DOT justified killing the rule by citing a recent congressional move that eliminated the statutory mandate for the hotline itself. They framed it as consistent with the administration's broader goal of reducing regulation.
So easier for airlines, but maybe harder for consumers to find help.
That's the potential trade-off. It eases a compliance burden for airlines, sure, but it also subtly reduces consumer access to a direct federal channel for raising issues with air travel. Next, we saw the board of directors of the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, approve a notice of proposed rulemaking. This one was about amending their regulations on the official FDIC sign, you know, the one that says your deposits are insured. The proposal aims to simplify the requirements for banks displaying that sign on digital platforms like websites and mobile apps. The goal stated was to reduce compliance burdens by focusing the signage requirements only where they're most relevant to consumers.
Okay, simplifying rules. What's the potential downside there?
Well, it will likely lower operational costs for banks. But the potential flip side is it might subtly reduce consumer clarity about exactly which digital financial products are covered by deposit insurance, especially as those products get more complex.
And then you mentioned a particularly significant shift within DOT, specifically involving the Federal Transit Administration, the FTA. What was so fundamental about that one?
Right. This one really highlights the ideological drive behind some of these changes. The FTA, which is part of DOT, issued a proposal to comprehensively revise its policy guidance for evaluating the environmental benefits of big transit projects seeking federal funding. These are called Capital Investment Grant, or CIG, projects. The key change here is the elimination of a pretty complex methodology. The old way calculated environmental benefits based on how a project affected things like vehicle miles traveled, energy use, and crucially, greenhouse gas emissions.
Okay, so they're dropping that complex calculation. What are they replacing it with, and what's the most significant part of this change?
They're replacing it with something much simpler. But the most significant part, the real bombshell, is that the FTA proposed to completely remove any consideration of the social cost of carbon from its analysis entirely.
Removing the social cost of carbon? How did they justify that?
They explicitly cited Executive Order 14154. That order characterizes the social cost of carbon calculation as having, and I'm quoting loosely here, a poor basis in empirical science and being marked by politicization. So instead of trying to quantify the long-term climate damage costs avoided by a project, the new method would just rely on a simpler designation from the EPA about whether a local area currently meets air quality standards.
Wow. That sounds like more than just a technical adjustment.
It really is. This isn't just tweaking the numbers. It's a fundamental redefinition of how the federal government calculates benefit and cost in its policy analysis, particularly for infrastructure. It effectively dismisses the broad consensus among many economists and climate scientists about quantifying climate impacts. It reframes environmental benefit primarily as a localized, immediate air quality issue rather than a global, long-term climate challenge.
And the implication for which projects get funding.
It will almost certainly alter which major infrastructure projects get federal dollars. It likely favors projects that address existing air pollution in specific urban areas, while systematically disadvantaging projects that might offer greater overall climate benefits, like reducing long-term emissions or preventing future environmental harm.
Okay, huge shift there. What about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB? Any similar moves from them?
Yes, rounding out this flurry of regulatory activity on the 19th, the CFPB released its updated list of regulatory and rulemaking priorities. Now, their agenda does include a plan for a broad rulemaking to formally define what constitutes unfair, deceptive, or abusive acts or practices UDAP that could provide more clarity for the financial industry.
But there's a however coming, I suspect.
There is. However, the announcement also signaled that the agency is considering raising the asset thresholds that define a larger participant in several key consumer finance markets. Think auto financing, consumer debt collection.
Raising the threshold means fewer companies fall under their direct oversight.
Exactly. Raising that threshold would reduce the number of companies subject to the CFPB's direct supervisory authority. So while they might be providing clarity on UDAP, they could simultaneously be lessening their own regulatory footprint, which might mean reduced oversight and potentially fewer protections for consumers dealing with a wider range of financial companies.
So when you look at all these specific agency actions together,
yeah.
DOT, FDIC, FTA, CFPB, all announced around the same time, using similar language. Is this really coordinated or just a coincidence of timing?
The consistency is just too striking to be pure coincidence. The timing, the language used, like reducing regulations, simplifying requirements, reducing burden, and the underlying substance of these announcements, it all points strongly towards synchronized execution. These don't look like isolated actions of independent agencies acting on their own timetables. They strongly suggest the execution of a central White House directive aimed at what proponents might call streamlining government, and critics call the deconstruction of the administrative state.
And that executive order cited by the FTA is a key piece of evidence for that coordination.
It's the clearest piece of evidence, yes. The explicit citation of Executive Order 11154 in the FTA's proposal directly links that specific agency action to a single, coherent, top-down political philosophy. It strongly suggests coordination, most likely quarterbacked by the Office of Management and Budget, OMB.
Okay, so what's the big picture implication of this coordinated regulatory shift? What's the third order effect here?
The big implication is twofold. For regulated industries, they can likely anticipate more deregulatory relief coming down the pike in other sectors. This could mean reduced compliance costs, maybe new market opportunities. But for public interest groups, consumer advocates, environmental groups, they now face a multi-front battle. They have to stretch their resources, legal, advocacy, research across numerous policy areas simultaneously, as the fundamental approach to regulation is systematically changed. It's a much harder fight when the ground rules themselves are shifting everywhere at once.
Beyond these really broad, seemingly coordinated shifts, were there also individual departmental actions happening around the same time that maybe weren't part of that regulatory push, but still advanced the administration's priorities in other areas?
Yes, definitely. Individual departments took specific actions on August 19th that, while perhaps not part of that synchronized regulatory rollback, certainly aligned with and advanced the administration's broader policy goals in areas like biosecurity, energy policy, and even international enforcement.
Okay, like what? Give us an example.
Well, for instance, the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, announced it had authorized the FDA to permit the emergency use of certain animal drugs. This was specifically to combat a growing threat from the New World screwworm.
Screwworm? Sounds unpleasant. How does this connect to broader policy?
It connects because this HHS action was a direct complementary response to a major initiative unveiled just days earlier by the USDA, the Department of Agriculture. The USDA announced a sweeping plan to protect the U.S. food supply from this pest. That plan involves building a whole new sterile fly production facility down in Texas, significantly increasing border surveillance using mounted patrol officers they actually call tick riders, and boosting partnerships with Mexican authorities to treat and contain the pest south of the border.
So a big multi-agency response. What's the underlying significance here?
What's really crucial is how they're framing this. This coordinated multi-agency response demonstrates the application of what looks like a national security framework to what's traditionally been seen as, you know, an agricultural or public health issue. The language the USDA used, things like protect the United States border, and the scale of the response, including new infrastructure and border patrols, it really mirrors the tactics you'd expect in a defense or security operation.
So reframing biosecurity as border security?
Essentially, yes. Reframing biosecurity as a matter of border security and national sovereignty. This is a significant policy development. Now, it could lead to more funding, expanded powers for agencies like USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, APHIS. But the potential downside is it might also lead to trade or travel restrictions that are maybe more severe, perhaps more politically motivated, than what purely scientific or veterinary criteria would justify.
Interesting reframing. And the USDA also weighed in on another major policy area that same day, solar energy. That seems like an unexpected combination.
It certainly is an interesting intersection. In a move with potentially big implications for energy policy, the USDA also announced a new directive. This one blocks the use of taxpayer dollars for installing solar panels on land that's designated as prime farmland. And they made sure this got attention. The announcement was made by Agriculture Secretary Brooke L. Rollins down in Tennessee, standing alongside the state's governor and senators. High political visibility.
Blocking solar on prime farmland. What's the conflict there?
It creates a direct land use conflict between two national priorities. Boosting renewable energy versus protecting traditional agriculture. And in this directive, the administration is clearly siding with traditional agriculture. This policy really stands in stark contrast to efforts in previous years, sometimes bipartisan, to promote something called agrivoltaics.
Agrivoltaics.
Yeah, it's the idea of co-locating agricultural activities with solar energy production on the same land, trying to make both work together. This new USDA policy seems to reject that possibility, setting up an either conflict.
So what are the likely ripple effects of this decision?
Well, it creates a new and potentially significant regulatory hurdle for the utility-scale solar industry. It signals that the administration views large-scale solar expansion as a potential threat to the nation's agricultural base. The likely effects: probably a slowdown in solar development, especially in key agricultural states. It could increase land acquisition costs for solar developers, forcing them onto less productive, maybe more expensive land. And it could create new friction between federal energy policy and state-level goals or mandates for renewable energy.
Okay, so agriculture versus solar. Were there any other quick departmental actions worth flagging from that day?
Just briefly, yes. In the realm of international law enforcement, the Department of State announced it had debarred 17 individuals for violations related to the Arms Export Control Act. Details weren't provided, but it underscores ongoing enforcement in that area. And the Department of Defense published a notice about proposed changes to the rules for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Just signals an ongoing effort to refine and update the military justice system.
Okay, so that's a real whirlwind of executive action, a truly high-tempo period, as you said. But what about the legislative branch? You might expect, you know, a lot of debate, maybe some pushback, given all these executive moves. But what we actually saw, or didn't see, is quite telling, isn't it? Especially given the timing.
That's an excellent observation, and really crucial to understanding the full picture. During this period we're focused on, the legislative branch was largely quiet. Both the House and the Senate were in their scheduled August recess, what they often call a state work period back home. Despite this legislative lull, however, one critical and notably bipartisan piece of national security legislation was actually finalized and signed into law, which is interesting in itself.
Right, that shows something can still get done even during recess if there's consensus.
Exactly. It demonstrates a capacity for Congress and the White House to advance very targeted, consensus-driven priorities even when formal sessions aren't happening.
And that bill was H.R. 1316. The Maintaining American Superiority by Improving Export Control Transparency Act. Can you break down its core provisions for us? And why is this specific bill so significant right now?
Absolutely. So on August 19th, President Trump signed H.R. 1316 into law. And as you noted, it's important to stress this had broad bipartisan and bicameral support, something increasingly rare, especially on potentially contentious issues touching economic and national security. What the law does is amend the Export Control Reform Act of 2018, or ECRA, and its clear aim is to significantly enhance congressional oversight of the U.S. export control system.
How does it enhance oversight? What's the mechanism?
The core provision mandates that the Secretary of Commerce submit a highly detailed annual report to the relevant congressional committees, think foreign affairs, banking, etc. This report has to provide a really comprehensive accounting of applications for licenses to export, re-export, or transfer certain sensitive dual-use items.
Dual-use meaning items with both civilian and potential military applications.
Precisely. And the report specifically focuses on exports of these items to what the law calls covered entities. These are defined quite specifically. Entities located in countries of strategic concern, namely China, Russia, and Iran, or entities that are already on specific U.S. government restriction lists, like the Commerce Department's entity list or the military end user list.
So Congress gets a new report. What's the key information in this report that they weren't necessarily getting systematically before? And why is that granularity so important for accountability?
The crucial part is the unprecedented level of detail this report demands. For every single license application covered, the report must specify the applicant's name, a description of the item including its technical classification number, the ECCN, the name and location of the end user, an estimate of the item's value, the Commerce Department's final decision, approved or denied, and the date the application was submitted.
Oh, that's already quite detailed. Is there more?
Yes, and this is critical. The law also requires the report to include details about any end-use checks that were conducted. That means the date, location, and the results of checks done to verify the item is actually being used by the stated end-user for the stated purpose in compliance with U.S. export rules.
Wow. So it creates a real paper trail for every sensitive export license decision.
Exactly. It's not just aggregate data. It's a powerful tool for Congress to scrutinize every decision, making sure national security is genuinely being prioritized. It's worth noting, though, that the specific information in the report, apart from aggregate statistics, is mandated to be kept confidential, exempt from public disclosure, mainly to protect companies' proprietary business information and potentially sensitive intelligence sources or methods related to those end-use checks.
What was the stated purpose behind pushing this law through? What specific concerns was it trying to address?
The stated purpose is very clear. Prevent cutting-edge American technology, especially dual-use tech, from being acquired by strategic adversaries like China, Russia, or Iran, where it could potentially be used against U.S. interests or U.S. allies. This legislation came about as a direct response to growing concerns within Congress, on both sides of the aisle, that the Department of Commerce's Bureau of Industry and Security, or BIS, the agency that handles these licenses, had at times been maybe overly permissive.
Permissive in what way? Prioritizing business over security.
That was the allegation. Concerns were raised that BIS might have been prioritizing U.S. commercial interests, you know, enabling sales for U.S. tech companies over national security imperatives, especially when it came to exports to entities in China. A House Foreign Affairs Committee review back in 2023 really highlighted these concerns and helped build the political momentum for this legislative fix.
Certainly sounds like a powerful new oversight mechanism Congress has given itself.
Yeah.
What are the broader implications of this law, both for how the government operates and maybe for the tech industry itself?
This law represents a truly significant move. It institutionalizes congressional oversight as a formal, ongoing check on the executive branch's discretion in this really critical intersection of technology, economics, and national security. While the executive branch still holds the authority to approve or deny the licenses, H.R. 1316 creates this mandatory, detailed paper trail, allowing Congress to scrutinize those decisions with a level of granularity that they just didn't have before, systematically at least.
So more pointed questions in hearings, maybe.
Definitely. That annual report will become a really powerful tool for oversight hearings. Lawmakers will be able to zero in on specific licensing decisions, question the rationale, and potentially pressure the administration, any administration, to adopt a more cautious, more hawkish posture on tech exports to rivals. This will almost certainly force BIS, the agency making the decisions, to be more careful, more security-focused in its reviews, simply knowing that every single decision will be documented and subject to this detailed congressional examination.
Is there a potential downside for U.S. companies in this?
There could be. A potential third-order effect of this heightened scrutiny could be a kind of chilling effect on U.S. technology companies. They might become more hesitant even to apply for licenses to export to China or other countries of concern, fearing the potential public relations fallout or congressional backlash if the license becomes controversial, even if it's ultimately granted by BIS. It adds a layer of political risk to those business decisions.
And the fact that this got through with such strong bipartisan support, as you mentioned, that adds another layer of significance, doesn't it? Suggests something deeper is going on.
It absolutely does. The strongly bipartisan nature of H.R. 1316 is highly significant in today's polarized environment. You had co-sponsors ranging from Ronny Jackson, a conservative Republican from Texas, to Sarah Jacobs, a progressive Democrat from California in the House. And in the Senate, Jim Banks, a Republican from Indiana, and Mark Warner, the Democratic chair of the Intelligence Committee from Virginia. And its passage in the Senate was by unanimous consent, meaning essentially no one objected.
What does that consensus tell us?
This broad agreement demonstrates that strategic competition with China, particularly concerning technology, has solidified as one of the few areas of durable bipartisan consensus in Washington. It signals pretty clearly to both U.S. allies and adversaries that a more restrictive, more security-conscious approach to controlling technology exports is likely to be a lasting feature of U.S. foreign policy, regardless of which party controls Congress or the White House. And for the U.S. tech industry itself, it's arguably a definitive sign that the era of relatively easy, unfettered access to the massive Chinese market is well and truly over. The focus has shifted decisively towards managing national security risks.
Okay, so that's a major bipartisan legislative achievement focused on China and tech. But as you said, it happened while Congress was mostly out of town. What does the fact of the congressional recess itself tell us about all these other federal actions we've been discussing? Does that timing change the dynamic?
It certainly does. The legislative calendar itself played a really crucial role in shaping the political dynamics of this entire period. As we noted, both the Senate and the House were in their scheduled August state work period, basically, recess, allowing members to be back in their home states or districts. On August 19th, the Senate only met for a very brief pro forma session, which is just a procedural formality with no actual legislative business conducted. And the House had already adjourned entirely until August 22nd. So consequently, no new bills were introduced, no debates were held at the federal level on either August 19th or 20th. It was a genuine legislative lull.
A legislative lull. And your analysis suggests this wasn't just incidental, but perhaps strategically significant for the executive branch. How so?
Precisely. This congressional recess effectively created a kind of policy vacuum in Washington, D.C. And this period of legislative quiet or quiescence appears to have been strategically exploited by the executive branch. The timing of that federal takeover of the D.C. police force, the timing of that flurry of significant regulatory changes we discussed earlier, it seems highly unlikely to be purely coincidental that they happened during this recess.
Why? What advantage does the recess give the administration?
Because with Congress out of session, the primary mechanisms for immediate political accountability are simply off the table. Think about it. No oversight hearings can be convened immediately. You can't easily call administration officials up to Capitol Hill to testify to four committees. You can't quickly introduce legislation to try and counter or block these executive actions. Those tools are unavailable when lawmakers aren't there.
So the administration gets a window to act with less friction.
Exactly. The administration effectively leveraged this window of opportunity to push through controversial policies with minimal immediate friction from the legislative branch. This dynamic fundamentally alters the normal interbranch balance of power, at least temporarily. It allows the White House to seize the initiative, set the agenda, and create new facts on the ground. And the consequence is, by the time lawmakers return to Washington in September, these policies are already being implemented. They're more entrenched. It becomes significantly harder politically and practically to challenge or reverse them. It forces Congress into a reactive posture, responding to an agenda that's already been decisively shaped by unilateral executive action during their absence.
Okay, so the executive branch is hyperactive, the legislative branch is strategically quiet. That leaves us with the third branch, the judiciary. And even though the Supreme Court itself was in recess, you're saying there were some truly significant rulings coming out of other federal courts that give us a fascinating snapshot of the current legal landscape.
Indeed. While the Supreme Court justices were on their summer break, the rest of the federal judiciary remained highly active. On August 19th, specifically, several appellate and district courts issued rulings with potentially profound implications for constitutional law, for the balance of power between government and citizens, and for key national debates. These decisions touched on core issues like Second Amendment rights, the very structure and power of federal agencies, the administrative state, and the continuing relevance and power of the Voting Rights Act. So yeah, a very active day in the courts below the Supreme Court.
Let's start with those federal appellate courts then. What were the standout rulings there, and what do they signal about how the law is being interpreted by these influential courts right now?
On August 19th, we saw several U.S. courts of appeals hand down significant, potentially precedent-setting decisions that really directly challenged the scope of government authority in different ways. First, in a really landmark Second Amendment case, Ortega v. Grisham, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit reversed a lower court's decision. It found that New Mexico state law imposing a 7-day waiting period for firearm purchases is likely unconstitutional.
Likely unconstitutional. On what grounds? What was their reasoning?
Their reasoning was rooted firmly in a very strict interpretation of the Supreme Court's major 2022 decision in New York State Rifle and Pistol Association v. Bruin. You'll recall the Bruin decision basically said that for any gun regulation to be constitutional today, the government has to prove it's consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation back when the Second Amendment was adopted. The Tenth Circuit panel looked at waiting periods, or cooling off periods, and concluded they are essentially a modern invention. They couldn't find a strong historical analog from the founding era, and therefore, under Bruin's test, the waiting period law likely fails.
And the immediate impact of that ruling?
The immediate implication is that the ruling prevents New Mexico from enforcing that waiting period law while the case continues to be litigated. It effectively invalidates, for now at least, a key gun control measure in that state, and more broadly, radically curtails the state's ability to regulate the acquisition of firearms based on contemporary public safety arguments if those arguments don't have a clear historical parallel. It's a very significant application of Bruin.
Okay, a major Second Amendment ruling. Then you mentioned the Fifth Circuit weighed in on the administrative state. That sounds like it could have even broader systemic implications for how federal agencies actually operate.
It absolutely does. This one has potentially far-reaching consequences for the entire structure of the federal government. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit affirmed a temporary injunction against the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB. This was in a consolidated case involving SpaceX and some other employers challenging the NLRB's authority. But what was most striking wasn't just affirming the injunction, it was the court's opinion, which strongly suggested didn't definitively rule yet, but strongly suggested that the very statutory structure of the NLRB itself is unconstitutional.
The whole agency's structure.
Their reasoning focused on the layers of protection against removal for the NLRB's key officials. They argued that having multiple layers of for-cause removal protection, meaning the president can't easily fire them for both the NLRB's main board members and its administrative law judges, ALJs, excessively insulates these officials from presidential control. The court suggested this insulation violates the separation of powers doctrine and improperly infringes on the president's constitutional authority to oversee the executive branch.
Wow, that's a fundamental challenge.
It really is. It calls into question the independent structure of a key federal agency, one that's been central to labor relations for decades. And if that reasoning holds and gets applied more broadly, it could set a precedent for challenging the structure and independence of many other federal agencies that operate with similar protections designed to insulate them from direct political interference, like the Federal Reserve, the FTC, the SEC. The list goes on. It's a major challenge to the concept of independent agencies.
Okay, so 10th Circuit on guns, 5th Circuit on agency structure, and the D.C. Circuit also had a ruling, this one on foreign aid cuts. How did that one play out?
Meanwhile, yes, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit handed the executive branch a significant win in a dispute over foreign aid funding. In a 2-1 split decision, the court overturned a district judge's earlier order. That lower court order had blocked the administration from implementing billions of dollars in planned cuts to foreign assistance programs.
Did the D.C. Circuit say the cuts themselves were legal?
No, they didn't actually rule on the merits of whether the cuts were legal or proper under budget law. Instead, the majority focused on a procedural issue. Legal standing. They found that the grant recipients who had originally filed the lawsuit lacked the required legal standing, basically, the recognized right to bring the case before a court to challenge the cuts in the first place.
So, a procedural win for the administration, but with a substantive impact.
Exactly. Because it was a procedural ruling, it didn't settle the underlying legal questions about the executive's power over appropriated funds. But its practical effect was to lift the injunction and allow the administration to proceed with its planned reduction in foreign aid spending. The broader implication here is that it significantly strengthens the executive's hand in controlling how congressionally appropriated funds are spent by making it potentially harder for affected groups or individuals to successfully challenge those spending decisions in court based on standing requirements. It narrows the pathway for legal challenges.
So when we synthesize these three major appellate rulings, 10th Circuit, 5th Circuit, D.C. Circuit, all handed down around the same day, what common threads or trends emerge? Do they point towards a particular dominant legal philosophy gaining traction?
They really do seem to point in a similar direction. These three rulings, taken together, they aren't just routine judicial decisions applying settled law. They represent pretty fundamental challenges to the established authority of both state governments in the New Mexico case and the federal government's own administrative structures and spending processes. They reveal what looks like a clear jurisprudential trend emerging, particularly from conservative-leaning appellate courts appointed in recent years.
And what is that trend? What's the through line?
The through line seems to be a deep skepticism of modern regulatory structures, whether state-level gun control or federal agency independence. There's also a noticeable deference to executive authority, particularly the president's power, as seen in the NLRB case reasoning and the D.C. Circuit's standing decision. And underpinning it all is a strong commitment to originalist or textualist interpretations of constitutional rights and structures, like the 10th Circuit's reliance on historical tradition for the Second Amendment. This combination creates a legal landscape that appears highly favorable to the administration's broader agenda of deregulation, consolidation of executive power, and shifting away from established norms.
And the likely third-order effect of these appellate rulings.
The almost certain effect will be a new wave of litigation. These powerful precedents restricting state gun laws based on history, questioning agency independence, limiting standing to challenge spending will inevitably be cited and used by litigants to challenge other state gun laws across the country. The structure and actions of other independent federal agencies like the FTC or SEC, and potentially other aspects of federal spending and administration, it opens the door for many more such challenges.
So a very clear trend from these appellate courts, generally favoring executive power, challenging regulation, leaning on originalism. But you said it wasn't a completely clean sweep across the entire judiciary that day. There was one significant counterpoint, right?
That's a crucial distinction, yes, and a really significant one. Providing a powerful counterpoint to the trend we just discussed from those appellate courts, a federal district court down in Mississippi issued a strong affirmation of federal voting rights law. On August 19th, U.S. District Judge Sharian Acock ordered the state of Mississippi to redraw the electoral map used for electing justices to its state Supreme Court. In her ruling, Judge Acock found that the current district lines, which remarkably had been in effect since 1987, violate Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965.
Violate Section 2.
Yeah.
What was the basis for that finding? What evidence did the court rely on?
The court concluded that the map illegally dilutes the voting strength of black residents in Mississippi. The plaintiffs successfully argued that the way the districts were drawn denied black voters an equal opportunity to elect candidates of their choice to the state's highest court. The evidence was pretty stark. Despite Mississippi's population being nearly 40% black, the state's 9-member Supreme Court has had only 4 black justices in its entire history. And crucially, every single one of those was initially appointed by a governor to fill a vacancy in the same single district out of the several districts used. The court found this was strong evidence of vote dilution caused by the map structure.
So the ruling wasn't just a finding of violation, it included a remedy.
Yes. The ruling mandated that the Mississippi State Legislature must now devise a new fair map for electing its Supreme Court justices, one that remedies this illegal vote dilution and complies with the Voting Rights Act.
That sounds like a major victory for civil rights advocates, especially given the broader legal trends we've been discussing. But what are the implications here? Is this victory secure?
It is indeed a landmark victory for civil rights advocates in that specific case. And it demonstrates that the Voting Rights Act, particularly Section 2, still remains a potent tool, though frequently challenged, for protecting minority representation in voting. Despite some recent Supreme Court decisions that have weakened other sections of the VRA, this Mississippi ruling confirms that Section 2's prohibition on discriminatory voting practices and structures is still enforceable and can be used to compel fundamental changes to a state's electoral systems, even ones that have been in place for decades. It shows litigation is still a viable path.
But you sound a note of caution. Why might the victory be tenuous?
Well, the caution comes from the context. The third order implication here is that this decision, finding a state Supreme Court map violates the VRA, will almost certainly be appealed by the state of Mississippi. It will go up to the very conservative Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, the same court that questioned the NLRB's structure, and from there, potentially, to the U.S. Supreme Court. Given the current composition and recent jurisprudence of both the Fifth Circuit and the Supreme Court, which have shown increasing skepticism towards broad applications of the Voting Rights Act, this case is unfortunately poised to become a crucial test, a test of the continued viability and strength of Section 2 itself as a bulwark against vote dilution nationwide. So a major win for now, but the fight is likely far from over.
And speaking of the Supreme Court,
yeah,
what was their role in all of this, even while they were officially in recess? You mentioned the shadow docket earlier. Can you explain that?
All right. The U.S. Supreme Court itself was, as we said, in its summer recess during this period. So as expected, they didn't issue any formal opinions or orders on argued cases on August 19th or 20th. However, when we look beyond the formal opinions and analyze the court's actions on its emergency docket, this is what's often referred to critically as the shadow docket. Throughout the year 2025, a distinct and highly impactful pattern emerges.
An impactful pattern? What kind of pattern?
The pattern is that the court has quite consistently granted the Trump administration's requests for emergency stays or temporary halts of lower court injunctions that had blocked administration policies. This has allowed the administration to move forward with a whole range of controversial policies, things like plans to significantly reduce the federal workforce, efforts to remove commissioners from supposedly independent agencies, even after federal judges had reviewed the evidence and found these actions were likely illegal and had ordered them stopped.
So, the Supreme Court uses the shadow docket to let the administration proceed anyway while the case is appealed.
In many significant instances, yes, that's the effect. The court grants an emergency stay, lifting the lower court's block, often with little or no explanation provided publicly.
So this shadow docket isn't just some obscure procedural thing then. It sounds like it's become a really significant tool, almost a policy lever for the executive branch.
That's absolutely correct. It's far more than a procedural quirk. The Supreme Court's shadow docket, particularly its use in granting these emergency stays for the government, has effectively become a key enabler of the executive agenda in recent times. While these emergency orders are technically temporary and not full decisions on the legal merits of the case, their practical effect is often decisive, at least in the medium term.
Awesome.
By granting a stay, the court allows the challenged policy to be fully implemented. And this often happens for months, sometimes even years, while the underlying legal challenges slowly work their way through the normal, often very lengthy, appellate process. You often see dissenting justices from these shadow docket orders warning explicitly that the court's action allows irreparable harm to occur to individuals, to the environment, to institutions, before the legality of the policy is ever definitively resolved. And by the time a final decision is reached, maybe years later, the policy's effects may be incredibly difficult, maybe even impossible to fully reverse.
Some shadow docket actions function almost like de facto victories for the administration, even if they might lose the case eventually on the merits.
That's exactly how critics describe it. This pattern of granting stays functions as a series of de facto victories for the administration pushing the challenged policy. It sends a powerful signal to the White House that it can pursue policies that are legally dubious, maybe even norm-breaking, with a pretty high probability that the Supreme Court won't stand in its way, at least not immediately through an injunction. This dynamic arguably emboldens further assertions of executive power and significantly weakens the ability of the lower federal courts to serve as an effective, timely check on the presidency during these crucial initial phases of policy implementation.
Okay. So when we try to pull all of these complex threads together, this whirlwind of executive actions, the strategically quiet but still impactful legislative moment with that export control bill, and these really striking judicial trends from the appellate courts and the Supreme Court shadow docket, what's the big picture that emerges? What are the dominant themes you see weaving through this intense period of federal activity?
It's a lot to synthesize, for sure. But when you do pull it all together, a few dominant themes really stand out, characterizing the interbranch dynamics and the overall direction of federal power during this period. First, there's what you could almost call a blitzkrieg strategy. The sheer volume, the speed, and the significance of all these actions, executive orders, regulatory rewrites, court rulings crammed into such a short time frame, especially leveraging that congressional recess. It points strongly towards a deliberate strategy, a strategy of overwhelming the political and legal systems, moving swiftly on multiple fronts to implement transformative change before opposition can fully mobilize or the normal checks and balances can effectively engage.
Okay, speed and volume is a strategy. What's the second theme?
Second is the unmistakable consolidation of executive power. There's a very clear through line connecting so many of the things we've discussed. The federal crackdown in D.C., bypassing local authority, the judicial challenges aimed at dismantling the independence of federal agencies like the NLRB, the executive branch successfully asserting control over foreign aid spending despite legal challenges, and the strategic use of the Supreme Court's emergency docket to greenlight administration actions. Each of these actions, in its own way, works to expand the power, the discretion, the authority of the presidency, often at the direct expense of other power centers, local governments, independent federal bodies, the congressional power of the purse, and even the authority of the lower courts to provide immediate checks.
And the third major theme.
Third is a clear ideological realignment of policy. The actions we've tracked aren't random, they're not disconnected, they're not purely opportunistic. They seem guided by a consistent and pretty well-defined ideology across different domains. This ideology clearly prioritizes deregulation, especially in the financial and transportation sectors. It favors traditional energy sources and conventional agriculture over green energy development and climate mitigation. It pursues that transactional bilateral approach to foreign policy over multilateralism and alliances. And it implements a very hardline, enforcement-first approach to domestic security and immigration. It's a coherent worldview being implemented rapidly.
That's a powerful synthesis. Blitzkrieg strategy, consolidation of executive power, ideological realignment. So stepping back one more time, what does all this mean for the different groups and entities out there trying to navigate this rapidly changing landscape? What are the key strategic implications for them as they look ahead?
This rapidly evolving policy landscape, driven by those themes, presents a really complex mixture. a duality almost of immense opportunities for some and significant risks and challenges for others. It really depends on who you are and where you sit.
Let's break that down. What about for the business and financial community? Opportunity or risk?
For the business and financial community, it's truly that duality you mentioned. On one hand, the aggressive deregulatory push in banking, transportation, environmental review creates immediate opportunities. Potential for reduced compliance costs, streamlined operations, faster project approvals. That's the opportunity side. However, this is counterbalanced by potentially profound long-term uncertainty. The transactional, often unpredictable nature of trade policy, like we saw at the Thailand deal, means tariff landscapes can shift rapidly, potentially disrupting global supply chains with little warning. That's a risk. And maybe even more fundamentally, these legal challenges to the very structure of regulatory agencies like the NLRB, if they succeed, they could upend decades of established labor law, administrative law. That kind of upheaval creates massive instability for businesses that have built their entire operational models around the existing legal framework. So opportunity in deregulation, but risk in instability and unpredictability.
Okay, a mixed bag for business. What about for international actors, U.S. allies and adversaries? What signals are they receiving?
For international partners and adversaries, the United States is sending a very clear, very unambiguous signal, a preference for bilateral power-based negotiations over multilateral rules-based systems. For U.S. allies, they may find themselves, like Thailand perhaps, feeling pressured into transactional deals to avoid punitive tariffs or maybe to gain specific favorable access to the U.S. market. This approach might yield short-term wins for the U.S., but it risks eroding that long-term trust and predictability that really underpin traditional alliances. It could weaken alliance cohesion over time, making coordinated international responses to global challenges harder. For U.S. adversaries, particularly China, they'll certainly note that hardening bipartisan consensus on technology controls, now formally institutionalized by that H.R. 1316 law, they'll see that as a permanent structural feature of U.S. policy they need to contend with. However, they might also see new opportunities. Opportunities to exploit the divisions potentially created by the administration's transactional approach with its traditional allies. Weakening those alliances could be strategically advantageous for rivals.
And finally, what about for domestic policy groups, civil society organizations, advocacy groups here in the U.S.? What are the implications for them?
For domestic policy and civil society organizations, well, they face what looks like an unprecedented multi-front battle right now. The federalization of D.C. policing, the shifting judicial landscape on core civil rights issues like the Second Amendment and the Voting Rights Act, these demand a massive coordinated litigation and advocacy response just to try and hold the line or push back. Simultaneously, the systematic removal of environmental considerations from federal policymaking, the rollback of consumer protections, these require a similarly concerted effort to challenge the changes at the agency level, in the courts, in the public sphere. And this incredibly daunting task is made exponentially more difficult by the sheer speed and breadth of the administration's actions across all these fronts at once. It stretches resources thin, makes it hard to keep up. The current period, from their perspective, is likely defined by the rapid erosion of established norms, regulations, and legal precedents. And that requires an equally rapid, flexible, and adaptive response from those organizations seeking to preserve them or offer alternative visions. It's a challenging time for them.
What a comprehensive deep dive. We've really covered a tremendous amount of ground, tracking the rapid shifts across the executive, legislative, and judicial branches just since August 19th. From those big diplomatic maneuvers and the intense domestic security operations in D.C., to that major regulatory overhaul, and the pivotal, sometimes contradictory, court rulings, it's undeniably clear the federal landscape is being fundamentally reshaped and at an incredible pace. Your insights into the Blitzkrieg strategy, that consolidation of executive power, and the clear ideological realignment really help connect the dots, showing how these seemingly disparate actions actually form a coherent, if unsettling for some, whole. And for you, our listener, understanding these dynamics, these themes, it isn't just about knowing the day's news headlines. It's really about seeing the powerful underlying currents that are going to impact policy, the economy, international relations, and maybe even aspects of daily life for years to come. So as we consider this intense period of federal activity, maybe the question that truly resonates, the one to leave you with, is this. In a system that was designed with intricate checks and balances between the branches, what happens when one branch finds itself able, or perhaps is enabled, to leverage a strategic moment like a congressional recess, or a judiciary that seems increasingly receptive, or both to accelerate its agenda to such an unprecedented degree? How does that acceleration, that leveraging of a moment, change the fundamental equilibrium of power in our system? And what does it demand of us as informed citizens trying to make sense of it all to truly understand the path we're on and the path ahead? Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. Until next time, keep digging, keep questioning.
It's always a pleasure to unpack these crucial topics. Thank you for listening.